Before we start today's show, we want to share some exciting news from the Radiotopia family. Normal Gossip is back for its sixth season. If you've ever found yourself eavesdropping on strangers' juicy conversations and maybe wanting to chime in too, this show is for you. On Normal Gossip, host Kelsey McKinney shares the juiciest gossip sent in by listeners all around the world, then brings in a special guest to weigh in on the actions within the story. The stories are everything from petty to bizarre to downright strange. Fun fact, you might recognize a few of this season's guests from the Radiotopia universe. So check it out. New episodes start April 17th. Listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Radio Diaries is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiotopia.
From PRX.
From PRX's Radiotopia, this is Radio Diaries. I'm Joe Richman. Today on the podcast, we're bringing you a story we produced for This American Life. At the center of this story is a book called The Education of Little Tree. In the book, a boy named Little Tree is five when his parents die. He then goes to live in the woods with his Cherokee grandparents, who teach him to respect the earth, to take only what he needs from nature, and to appreciate the fundamental human virtues of respect and tolerance. The Education of Little Tree was first published in the mid-1970s as an autobiography by Forrest Carter. It's been a staple of high school English and history classes for decades.
I really liked it. I found that I really connected to Little Tree. I felt like he was a lot like me, sort of. We're both trying to become better people. I'm trying to learn to be a good person, become who I am, be a man. But so was Little Tree.
That's a student from Masconomet Regional High School in Topsfield, Massachusetts, where students have gathered to discuss the book after their sophomore English class. Now, there's one thing I should tell you about The Education of Little Tree, a thing that some of you may already be aware of. The book is a lie. It's not an autobiography. It's all made up. Today, the true story of the untrue story of The Education of Little Tree. The story begins with the most famous racist political speech in American history.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is the day of my inauguration as governor of the state of Alabama. And this day,
during the Civil Rights era, George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, was the personification of Southern racism. He was the one who famously stood in the schoolhouse door to prevent two black students from enrolling at the University of Alabama. But the moment that first really catapulted Wallace onto the national stage was his inauguration speech in 1963.
Let us send this message back to Washington that from this day we are standing up, and the heel of tyranny does not fit the neck of an upright man.
He was promising that he was going to stand alone for the Southern cause, the cause of the white people.
Wayne Greenhall was a young reporter in Alabama in the 1960s. He remembers listening to the speech and the famous words, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
It's vehement, it's mean-spirited, it's hateful. It's like a rattlesnake was hissing it almost. But it's beautifully written.
In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
This speech was a catalyst for much of the violence that followed. Just a few weeks later, Birmingham police used dogs and fire hoses on protesters. And later that same year, there was the bombing of a church in Birmingham, where four little girls were killed on a Sunday morning. Today, what most Americans know about George Wallace are those words, segregation now, segregation forever, even though they weren't actually his words. Behind those words, behind that speech, was an entirely different person. Asa Carter, the poet laureate of Southern racist speechwriting.
Segregation now, segregation forever, became Wallace's symbol. It all came from Asa Carter's pen, and nobody could write it any better than Asa.
It's time for another essay on liberty by Asa Carter.
Thank you. The one great truth is race. Each race has a character.
That's Asa Carter. He was a staunch segregationist. He started his own splinter branch of the KKK in Alabama. He wrote and published a white supremacist magazine. And every week, radio stations around Alabama would air Asa Carter's 15-minute liberty essays, which were about everything from his views on racial purity to the dangers of integration, communism, and rock and roll, all delivered with literary flair.
That's why the left-wingers so much wants to make our history a shrouded nothingness of confusion, to twist the songs of our fathers into bebop rhythms, and to degenerate our mores into a cacophony of chaos. You've been listening to Ace Carter with an essay on liberty.
In 1956, Asa had his KKK group attack singer Nat King Cole on stage because Asa hated the idea that a black musician was performing for white women. Asa reserved special hatred for the Jews, who he felt were really to blame for the corrupting power of popular culture. He once said, "The Negro is the virus, but it's the Jew that inserts it in the veins of America." And then in 1962, Asa got a new gig as George Wallace's speechwriter. Ron Taylor was a good friend of Asa Carter's.
They'd call him and tell him what they wanted, you know, and they'd just give him a cup of coffee and two packs of Pall Malls, and he could write you a 20-minute speech in 30 minutes.
Let's win, win, win with Wallace and help him pave the way.
Asa's speeches helped George Wallace become governor in 1962. But within a few years, the arrangement was falling apart. Tom Turnipseed was George Wallace's campaign director back then.
Times changed, and Wallace wanted to cool it a little bit. He didn't want to just come out and say, "I'm a segregationist." He didn't want to use that terminology anymore. He wanted to be more moderate. Asa's views were too extreme. And so Governor Wallace didn't need Asa anymore. Asa would call me up and talk with me on the phone some. And he was resentful because he just felt like he was being ignored. He was the guy that wrote the famous iconic speech, and now Wallace, he won't listen to me anymore. He won't talk with me. He won't take my advice. And so he felt used, I think, by Governor Wallace.
Upon which I am about to enter, to the best of my ability, to the best of my ability.
George Wallace was elected governor again in 1970. But this time, his inauguration speech was very different from the speech that Asa Carter had written back in 1963. Wallace said, "Alabama belongs to all of us, black and white, young and old, rich and poor alike." Reporter Wayne Greenhall was on the steps of the Capitol at the time, covering Wallace's inauguration address, and he happened to run into Asa Carter.
After the speech, I found Asa out on the back steps of the Capitol. And we sat on the stairs talking, and he started crying. He said, "Wayne, George Wallace sold out. He's betraying us to the liberals of this nation." He stood up and turned around and said, "Farewell."
"Well, I am just an old rebel. Reckon that is all I am. For this carpetbagger government, I do not give a dad blame. I'm glad I fit again it. I'll keep fighting till we won. And I don't want no pardon for nothing that I done. This is Asa Carter. May God bless you, and I thank you for listening."
And that's the last time I ever saw him. Asa Carter, he just vanished like he dropped off the face of the earth.
My name is Chuck Weath.
I'm Betty Weath.
And I and my wife ran a bookstore in our town of Abilene, Texas. In 1975, this man came walking in the store and said, "I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Forrest Carter."
He wore a cowboy hat, blue jeans, and had a mustache.
He's dark-complected, smile wrinkles around his eyes. He said he was Cherokee. And he was raised by his grandparents back in Tennessee. No electricity, no running water. And I liked him. From the very start, I liked him.
This new guy in town, Forrest Carter, quickly became a fixture in Abilene, Texas. Chuck and Betty Weath say Forrest was outgoing and friendly. He told people in town he never had any formal education and spent his adult life wandering between ranch jobs. And he entertained everybody with stories about his Cherokee childhood.
We had him to our house several times for supper, just because you wanted to hear a little more about this life, which I wasn't familiar with at all.
He was sort of the underdog of the American culture, and you were cheering for him, and you just grew to love him.
Chuck and Betty Weath knew Forrest was a writer and that he had written a Western. Forrest told them he was sending copies of the book to people in Hollywood.
He'd already approached Clint Eastwood, and lo and behold, Clint Eastwood was well enough taken by this first book. Forrest told us he's planning to make a movie of it, which indeed he did do, called The Rebel Outlaw, Josie Wales.
He lives by his word, and he lives for revenge. Clint Eastwood is the outlaw Josie Wales.
Why, you're going to pull those pistols and whistle Dixie.
During the time all this was happening, Forrest was hard at work on another book, a book he described differently than his first one. That was a novel. This was an autobiography, and he was calling it The Education of Little Tree. An orphan Cherokee boy, raised by his grandparents, who grows up to write a Hollywood movie starring Clint Eastwood. It was made for TV.
Good morning, this is Today. I'm Barbara Walters with Jim Hart.
And in fact, in 1975, Forrest was invited to New York to be a guest on the Today Show with Barbara Walters.
She introduced him as an Indian who had busted Broncos all over the Southwest.
While viewers around the country were being introduced to Forrest Carter, there were some people back in Alabama who recognized a man they hadn't seen in years. Ron Taylor remembers watching that morning as Forrest Carter told viewers he was the storyteller to the Cherokee Nation.
He had that black hat pulled way down. He just tanned himself up, grew a mustache, lost about 20 pounds, but as hard as he tried, he couldn't fool the folks back home. I literally got down in the floor laughing and rolling around. Called the wife. Ace was on TV. He's on with Barbara Walters. And I'm just rolling around on the floor laughing because Asa had pulled it. You know, he had fooled them.
By the time the Today Show aired around the country, reporter Wayne Greenhall had already been onto the story for a few months. The story that Asa Carter and Forrest Carter seemed to be the same person. The tip-off came when Wayne happened to write a review of Forrest Carter's first book, the one that became a movie. After the book review appeared in the paper, Wayne ran into an old friend of Asa Carter's, Ray Andrews.
And Ray said, old Asa's got you fooled too, huh? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, I saw you wrote a review of Asa's novel. I said, that's Forrest Carter. And Ray grinned and laughed and said, yeah, that's old Asa. Asa's Forrest Carter. I thought, what in the world? And it just bumfuzzled me.
After that original bumfuzzle, Wayne started to make calls.
I got in contact with Eleanor Freed, who was the editor at Delacorte Press, and she had discovered Forrest Carter. And when I told her this story, she said, oh, no, it couldn't be the same guy. He's such a sweet, gentle, fine man. He would never say a word about anybody because of the color of their skin. And I know he's not anti-Semitic because my husband and I are Jewish and we've had him to dinner a number of times and he's always just as nice as he could be. Just couldn't be the same man.
In fact, the editor told Wayne she was about to publish Forrest Carter's autobiography, The Education of Little Tree. Wayne told her he would still love to talk to Forrest Carter himself because he was writing a story for the New York Times about all this.
Sure enough, in a few days, Forrest Carter called me and he said, you this Greenhall boy writing about me? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, now you don't want to hurt old Forrest, do you, boy? And I said, come off of it. He said, I recognize that voice. I know you. You know me. We've drunk beer together. I said, I'm not trying to hurt you, but this business of Little Tree is not a true story. I said, I want to tell the truth about what is going on here. He said, oh boy, you know I don't do things like that. And he pretty much after that hung up.
Wayne had no idea why Asa was doing what he was doing. Why had he changed his name and become a storyteller to the Cherokee Nation? Why had he gotten a tan, slimmed down, and grown a mustache? And how did he expect to get away with going on TV and talking to Barbara Walters in a fake Texas accent? All Wayne knew was Forrest Carter was lying. He wasn't a Cherokee, this wasn't a memoir, and his name wasn't Forrest.
And the story ran in the New York Times, August 26, 1976, with the headline, Is Forrest Carter Really Asa Carter? Only Josie Wales may know for sure.
Wayne thought his New York Times article was going to set off a huge scandal. But a curious thing happened after the article came out, something that surprised Wayne Greenhall, and it probably surprised Asa and Forrest Carter. What happened was nothing. A few months later, Forrest Carter's autobiography, The Education of Little Tree, was published. And in fact, after Forrest/Asa died in 1979, the book just became more and more popular. In the late 1980s, The Education of Little Tree caught a wave of rising interest in all things Native American, and people seemed to identify with its themes: humility, tolerance, living in harmony with nature. A new paperback edition included a foreword by an actual Cherokee writer who called the book deeply poignant and compared it to Huck Finn. More than 1 million copies were sold. In 1991, the book reached number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. In 1994, Oprah Winfrey recommended it on her TV show. Every once in a while, a new article would come out revealing yet again the racist past of the book's author. And some small things would change. The New York Times moved the book from the nonfiction to fiction category. Oprah eventually took it off her book list. Some Native Americans said the book was full of stereotypes and was a complete fraud, but the Cherokee guy who wrote the foreword stood by it. It seemed that no matter what came out about the background of the book, its popularity continued. Today you can find it in Barnes & Noble, in the Native American section.
Most people who love the book simply could not imagine that a former Klansman, racist, anti-Semite, this person couldn't have written The Education of Little Tree.
This is historian Dan Carter, who, by the way, isn't related to Asa Carter, but he is writing a biography of the man, and he hits on the question that's at the center of the whole story. Is it possible that something happened in the heart of Asa Carter? Did he change? Was he a reformed racist trying to break from his shameful past, or was he just trying to make a buck? Or was it all just a joke on his New Age liberal readers? What does it mean that the man who wrote this?
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Could also write this.
One time Grandma told me, when you come on something good, first thing to do is share it with whosoever you can find. That way, the good spreads out where no telling how far it'll go.
Here's Asa Carter.
In the South, we have 98% Anglo-Saxon races, not counting the Negroes.
The only group Asa Carter hated more than blacks were Jews. So what does it mean that Forrest Carter created the character of Mr. Wine, a generous and sympathetic Jewish peddler who befriends Little Tree?
Mr. Wine said if you learnt to place a value on being honest and thrifty, on doing your best, and on caring for folks, this was more important than anything.
How could someone talk with so much venom?
We shall not submit to Negro dominion another day, another hour, another month. Behind every ballot is a bayonet, and the red blood of an Anglo-Saxon who holds it.
And still write something so sweet.
I could feel something more, as Grandma said I would. Mono Lao, the Earth Mother, came to me through my moccasins. I would have liked to live that time forever, for I knew I had pleased Grandpa. I had learned the way.
Actually, the live in harmony with nature message isn't really that surprising. You might expect a white supremacist to be nostalgic about living off the land. And someone can certainly write hate speech and still love nature. But what most readers took from the Education of Little Tree is a message of tolerance and respect for Native Americans and for the African American and Jewish characters in the book. In fact, the villains in the story aren't the minorities. They're the white politicians. For many people who love The Education of Little Tree, the only way to make sense of it was to take the book at its word and to believe that Asa Carter had truly changed. It wasn't an act, but a sincere transformation. Yes, okay, he wasn't a Cherokee orphan, but in his heart, he had become Forrest Carter. And Exhibit A for this point of view, for the people can change and people do change point of view, is Asa Carter's former boss, George Wallace, the man he wrote speeches for.
Primary elections are being held Tuesday, and George Wallace is trying a comeback, trying to become governor again.
At black meetings, Wallace repudiates his former racist stands.
And whether or not you've agreed with me at everything that I used to do and agree to, I know that you do not. I, too, see the mistakes that all of us made in years past.
This is footage from George Wallace's last campaign for governor in 1982. He was actually in a wheelchair, the result of an assassination attempt, and he was in the midst of what would be known as his apology tour, going around the state to black churches and civic groups, anyone who would have him, and saying, "I was wrong." One of the civil rights leaders Wallace apologized to was Congressman John Lewis, who still has a visible scar on his head from famously being beaten by Alabama state troopers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on the march to Selma, Alabama.
And I remember the occasion so well. It was like someone confessing to the priest or to a minister, just telling me everything and asking me about everybody, that he never had an opportunity to meet with Martin Luther King Jr., to meet Dr. King. He wanted people to forgive him. He said, "I never hated anybody. I never hated black people." He said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm sorry." And I said, "Well, Governor, accept your apology." I believe people have the capacity to change. I think he was sincere.
George Wallace was a lifelong politician, and it's impossible to say if his change of heart was authentic or not. But the people he was apologizing to believed it. In his last election as governor of Alabama in 1982, he won with 90% of the black vote. Wallace continued his apology tours long after he left public office. So George Wallace represents the transformation is possible theory. To people in Abilene, Texas, who are friends with Forrest Carter, the Cherokee writer, that's what happened to Asa Carter. He pulled a Wallace. Here's Chuck and Betty Weath.
I personally think the Forrest Carter I knew was sincere. The other life he seemed to have had as Asa Carter, I just sort of dismiss it.
I agree with that. I guess it's sort of that feeling that give a man a chance, he might change himself. And we felt like, well, he tried to change himself and he succeeded with us. I didn't like Asa Carter, I'll guarantee you. But I did like Forrest Carter.
There's another person who has some thoughts on this. One of the few people who knew both, Forrest and Asa Carter.
He was Uncle Asa to me. He wasn't Uncle Asa the white supremacist. He wasn't Uncle Asa the staunch segregationist. He was Uncle Asa, you know. So for me, it was my uncle wrote this wonderful book.
Carol Boyd is the daughter of Asa Carter's brother. She's never spoken about any of this on the record before. All of Asa's family members have kept silent for years. Like many of them, Carol was sheltered from most of the details of her uncle's racist past. The main thing she knew about her uncle, he was the true author of The Education of Little Tree. So when did you first read The Education of Little Tree?
I guess I was a senior in high school when I first read it. I loved it. I fell in love with it. I actually cried. I just think it's a beautiful story. I still read it today.
Carol describes herself as politically liberal. She voted for Obama twice. And to her, that book is all the proof she needs that in the end, her uncle wasn't so different in his views from her.
Just to have the ability to write that book, whether you present it as an autobiography or not, just to have that in you, I think, says that there is a good part of this person. I would hope that people would choose to believe. Maybe he found a softer side in his older years, and maybe he did change.
Did he change? That's the question you asked. No. No, 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 not at all. Not at all did he change.
This again is Ron Taylor, one of Asa Carter's friends from the early days back in Alabama. Ron would describe himself as the opposite of politically liberal, and he's chief proponent of theory number two.
No, 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 no.
Asa Carter did not change.
You know, I could do like some and just say, oh, you know, he didn't really mean that. You know, he didn't this, that, and the other, but did. You know, he did. And to refute it, like, say, Wallace did and people like that, then that makes their whole lives lies before them. I mean, old Wallace, after they wheeled him out in his wheelchair, and he apologized for everything he ever was, but Asa Carter wasn't going to apologize. He felt like he was right, and he lived it, and he died it. He just didn't change. He was Asa Carter.
There are some interesting clues that support Ron's theory. Many of the supposed Cherokee words in the book, Asa completely made up. Just nonsense words. Mona La, the Earth Mother, it comes up a lot. Not a word. The name Forest, it's not about communing with nature. It comes from Nathan Bedford Forrest. Never heard of him? He was the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And even the fact that the book is told from the point of view of a Cherokee kid, some white supremacists, it turns out, had a thing for Native Americans. KKK members sometimes bragged about being part Native American. It's the noble savage trope that goes back to D.W. Griffith films and much earlier. It may seem counterintuitive, but to Asa Carter, it was perfectly reasonable to glorify Native Americans while hating blacks and Jews. And there's one more thing. Asa's inscription in the copy of the book that he gave to Ron.
And this is my copy of it. It has gotten rather tattered. His signature page, it says, "For Ronnie, my friend, whose loyalty to the Southern cause has made us comrades. Forrest, Asa," end quote, "Carter." The only time he ever signed it that way.
All this leads Ron to a third theory, one I wasn't expecting. Asa didn't change, and he didn't fake a change. The education of Little Tree is exactly what Asa Carter always believed. Everyone else just misinterpreted it.
Well, one way you look at it, it's a tree hugger's book. You know, it's all about nature and, you know, and this, that, and the other. And the other way, it's a right-wing government leave me alone book, you know. The government took Little Tree and put him in an orphanage, you see. And the government passed the whiskey tax, and the government did this, and the government did that to the American Indian. And that's the way I read it. I was shocked when I found out other people was understanding it differently.
Ron feels that the education of Little Tree is speaking directly to him and to what he believes. But I asked Ron, what if it's the other way around? What if you're the one who's wrong?
Well, I would like to know myself if it's what I think it is. What I think it is, I think he wrote it for me. Me and my ilk. But I don't know that. Because it's probably been more interpreted the other way. The other way being the tree hugger way. As opposed to my anti-government, anti-cities, government intrusion in our daily lives, that type thing. I don't know. I know how I took it. But I also know that as many or more people took it the other way. Asa Carter. I wish I knew what he thought. I really do. But I honestly don't know.
I don't know myself what to make of the whole thing. But while I was working on this story, I picked up a new copy of The Education of Little Tree, and I started to read it to my two daughters. They're loving it. Of course, they don't know the backstory, and I'm not sure when I'm going to tell them. For me, it's kind of confusing to read the book and know the history. Like, am I a sucker for just reading it? Every once in a while, I'll come across a passage, like when 5-year-old Little Tree sees a hawk kill a young quail. It makes him sad. So his grandfather teaches him the way, which is about taking only what you need and about how nature weeds out the small and the slow so the species can grow stronger and more powerful. And I think, is this some white supremacist secret code of racial purity? Or is it just a lovely lesson about the circle of life and not being greedy? A few days ago, I was sharing a pastry with one of my daughters. I tore it in half and held out the two pieces. She chose the small one, and then she looked at me and said, "I have learned the way." For her, the book has nothing to do with small government or racial superiority. It's all about trying to understand people different from yourself, just being a good human being. Whatever Forrest Carter believed in his heart of hearts, it's safe to say, this is a book that Asa Carter would have hated. This story was originally produced for This American Life. Thanks to Alex Bloomberg and the staff of This American Life for all their help, along with Samara Freemark, Sarah Kate Kramer, Deborah George, and Ben Shapiro. You can also find a non-narrated Radio Diaries-style version of this story in our podcast archive. It's episode 14. Radio Diaries is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collective of the best podcasts on the planet. Check out the other shows at radiotopia.fm. We're going to let Asa Carter's old friend from back in the day, Ron Taylor, play us out. He and Asa wrote a song together after Little Tree came out. It was supposed to go in the movie version, but it never did.
Let me tell you of a time in Tennessee, on that mountain standing high against a clear and southern sky, on that smoky mountain ridge in Tennessee.
I'm Joe Richman. Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia.